Peter had a problem with Mary being placed in charge of the church. And Tebing states, there was a smear campaign against Mary. Well, you know what? There might have been. There's no real evidence that something like this is going on, but there could have been some harsh views of Mary in the early church. For example, when you think of Mary Magdalene, you perhaps think of a harlot. That's never taught in the New Testament. Sometimes it's hinted or said that Mary Magdalene may have been the woman taking adultery in John 8. Doesn't say that. In fact, John 8 has its own issues, but I just can't slow down on that. But it doesn't say that about Mary. So did somebody in the church spread something about Mary? Or I mean, 100, 200 years after Jesus. Maybe so. But there's no evidence of some kind of plot or something like that. In fact, in the church, it's really, really neat. In the church, women have a prominent role several times. In fact, we hear from the words of Jesus, the last shall be first, and the first shall be last. Do you know that we read in the book, a solitary verse in the book of Luke says that Jesus' ministry was paid for by several wealthy women? How'd you like to get to judgment and have someone ask you what you did with your time, talent, and treasures after you became a Christian? And be one of those ladies and say, I underwrote your son's ministry. That'd be pretty cool, wouldn't it? Can you think of anything? Can you think of anything you'd rather say than that? In addition to that, women are at the cross. Women are at the empty tomb. Women at the burial, empty tomb, and they're the first ones to see Jesus. And except for John at the cross and a few exceptions, the men are gone. So either God chose the women to be witnesses, or the men refused, or both. But that doesn't seem to me like the New Testament is prejudiced, you know, against women. All right, let's take a look at a few other things here. Today, critical scholars, second statement, today critical scholars acknowledge that Jesus had a very high view of women. And that's not argued a lot in the critical community. So it's not what Brown says. I think it's the opposite. I think women play a key role, and the two Marys and Salome and the others who go to the tomb and who are at the cross and so on. It's not an issue. I don't think there's any move to keep women from being this or being that. Don't forget, it's Paul who says in the book of Galatians that there's no gender in the body of Christ. There's no male or female. That's Paul. But we'll see in a minute that some of these ice cream moves, some of their favorite texts, do not say the same thing. Okay, let's take a look. This is the point right here. In Thomas 1:14, we don't see this in the Gospels. But the Gospel of Thomas is the sweetheart of the critical sources. And in Thomas 1:14, the last saying, basically we're told that women need to become men so they can go to the kingdom. It's a pretty high view of women, right? Jesus said he would make Mary a male so she could enter heaven. Sounds to me like some of these other sources are the ones who are going after women. All right, let's go to the marriage issue. Was Jesus married to Mary Magdalene? Here's the Gospel of Philip. This is a lot of fun. Christ loved her more than all the other disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth. And Tebing adds, by the way, the Aramaic word for companion literally means spouse. Okay, are they married? I said a moment ago there's one manuscript here. And let's take a look at what it says. Teeming says is the greatest cover-up. Not only was Jesus married, but he was a father. Okay? Next. In the Philip passage, Christ loved and mouth are not even in the text. Jesus loved her more than the other disciples. I mean, if he did, is that a problem? But it's just not there. And kissed her often on the... There's a hole in the manuscript. Kissed her often on the forehead, hand, cheek, mouth. Could be. But it's just not there. So who's guessing and who's putting the text together here? Moreover, when the professor says, and this text in the Aramaic means spouse. My response, who cares? The text is not written in Aramaic. It's written in Coptic, which is a type of Egyptian. And second blow, the word in Aramaic does not mean only spouse. So, I mean, he just can't get it right. But the point is, the words aren't there, and the Aramaic means nothing. Okay, so a moot point. Now, we can disagree about this. I was speaking at Virginia Tech a few days ago, and we got to the Q&A section, and a guy came to the microphone, and he said, I don't agree with your first comment about it wouldn't make a difference. That's fine. We can disagree about this. But I don't think it's an issue if Jesus were married. I don't think it's an issue if Jesus had children. I am not trying to keep Jesus pure from marriage and children. I don't think it's an issue. The problem is not Jesus wouldn't have been married. The problem is not no way Jesus would have kids. The problem is revisionist history, trying to make texts say things they don't say. That's the whole point that I'm after last night and tonight. This is about revisionist history. It's not about, do we have a huge problem if Jesus was married? In fact, I have to go back and check, but I believe that there's not a single early text, there's not a single text for hundreds of years that says Jesus was married. Not a single one. And we already said the Philip text does not say that. That word does not only mean spouse, and plus is not in Aramaic anyway, and we don't have the words loved her more than, we don't have the words on the mouth. So to me, it's not an issue if Jesus was married and had children. That's not an issue. Issue is, do we have evidence? Remember I ended last night by saying, you can say to critics, when they ask you things or come at you, you can say, I've given you some first century data for this. Why don't you give me, I'm really open to this. I'm really open to this. But you need to give me some first century data that Jesus is married and had children. They're not going to be able to give you first century data. They're probably not going to be able to give you first century, second century, third century, or fourth century data. I don't think something from multi-hundreds of years later should compete with the earliest documents. Again, if you have a problem with that, that's fine. I don't have a problem with Jesus being married or having children. That's not the issue. The issue is what does history teach? And it's not there. In fact, I'll tell you one reason that not only did the text not say Jesus was married, you might say, well, this is an argument from silence. We don't know he wasn't married. You might be right. Maybe. But you can't go and assert that he was when there's no text. But when Paul argues, I think it's 1 Corinthians 9, when Paul argues, don't I have a right to travel with a wife like Peter and the other apostles do? Don't I have a right to travel with a wife? Can I bring her and would you support her needs too? Don't I have that right? It doesn't just beg that he would have said, our Lord was married. Because Mary was with them everywhere. They hung around together because they were married. Wouldn't that support his argument wonderfully? He doesn't. He appeals to Peter, who was married. And we know that from the Gospels. Remember, Jesus heals Peter's mother-in-law. So, again, the problem is making ice cream-type selections when the text does not warrant that. There's such a desire today to get choices for Jesus. And the problem is you've either got to go late to get those choices or you don't have the choices at all. But the effort is to multiply the early, texts. An early a book came out last week, 2 weeks ago, arguing that when Jesus died, Mary and James became the leader of the early church, James' brother. Well, I'm sure James was prominent. He's the pastor of the Church of Jerusalem. I wouldn't be surprised, Mary, Jesus' mother now, not Mary Magdalene. I wouldn't be surprised if Mary, the mother of Jesus, had a very prominent place in the early church. It's, it's neither here nor there to me, as far as nothing hangs on it. Could be. But you don't see the church trying to squelch this kind of stuff. You don't see them kind of stepping on everybody who doesn't, if you take vanilla, you're going to hell. There's no move like that. So there's, women have a prominent place. They supported Jesus' ministry. They were God's chief witnesses at the end of his son's life. There's no effort here to try to say, you can't do that. You can't be one of the leaders. So I think you just let the text, all you can do is let the text speak for itself if you're an historian. Okay, conclusion for part two. Brown's characters criticize the deity, death, resurrection, uniqueness of Christ, criticize the reliability of Scripture. But if you critique these critiques by normal historiographical methods, they fail. I mean, that's all there is to it. You say, well, that's Da Vinci. It's a easy target. It is an easy target. But the reason we're talking about Da Vinci today is because, like the statistic I used last night, one in five Canadians in a recent survey, one in five Canadians said they believe Da Vinci. Someone asked me last night, why do so many people believe Da Vinci in the absence of data? I think it evidences that first point I started with last night. People want ice cream Jesus. They want alternatives. They want choices. And most of all, what comes from alternatives? You can't condemn them for not liking your flavor. The modern non-exclusive mindset, that'd be really nice. The problem isn't that, there aren't any differences. I already told you about the difference between Mark and John. That's not the issue. The issue is you can only deal with what you have, and you can only use the data you have. Most, quote, liberal scholars don't disagree with much of what I'm saying. They have their own translations. You can read them. And Bart Ehrman, the same guy I used as an example earlier, he's written a critique of Da Vinci. He's an agnostic. So it's good historiographical principles that make Da Vinci look bad. But we're not spending time with Da Vinci because it's an easy hit. It is that. But we're spending time with Da Vinci because it's so influential for non-scholarly reasons. That's what I said last night. People want to say, they say. There's a lot of they say in the book. And critics want to say, they say. They want to give these same objections. The sacred feminine. Weren't there several choices? Didn't you guys run roughshod over all the non-Orthodox books in the early canon? How? There weren't any. What did we leave out that would have hurt the cause of Christ to put in? We didn't have choices. Now, if the problem is we didn't wait long enough. Oh, by the way, let me answer one other question. The implication here is that the 27 New Testament books were chosen at Nicaea. There's no vote on what books go in the canon at Nicaea. Well, did it take 300 years to choose the books? No, I've already told you, Clement, Ignatius, Polycarp are already recognizing the Gospels, Acts, and Paul. They're already recognizing them by about 110, 125 AD. And the two blocks of books that are recognized, Gospels, Acts, Paul. Do you know how much that is in the New Testament? What percentage? I know it's only 2/3 of the New Testament in terms of book count. But as far as bulk, Gospels, Acts, and Paul are about 80% of the New Testament. And people are already quoting them. I mean, they're largely being cited by 110 A.D. and Papias by 125 A.D. It's pretty early. By 180 A.D., we already have what's called, actually about 170 A.D., we already have what's called Tatian's fourfold gospel, the fourfold gospel of Tatian. What's he got there? Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. 10 years later, the Muratorian canon, sometimes called the Muratorian fragment. We have almost the entire New Testament listed as books. Why not the whole New Testament? Well, one reason we don't, it's called the Muratorian fragment for a reason. The end of it's broken off. And but the books are, okay, that's 180, and almost the whole New Testament's there. What's the difference between 180 and 325? About 145 years. That's a long time. So put this together, and you've got the Gospels, Acts, Paul being recognized within 10, 15 years. You've got all four Gospels set side by side about 55 years after that. And you've got almost the whole New Testament set out from 10 years after that. Nobody waited until Nicaea to pick the books. Carl, how long do we go here? Are we still trying to stay on target? Two or three minutes? Okay. All right. I'm paying for the fact that Doug took my time this morning. I apologize to you for Doug. No, I'm okay. I'm all right. I'm fine. I'm just teasing. I tease these other guys as much as I can. It's good for us. All right. You have a question or comment? Yes. Philip? Thomas is probably the earliest non-canonical gospel. I think scholars would generally date Thomas, perhaps 150 A.D. Some might give Thomas a really early date. I mean, a real early date might be 125. Even the 125 date is, what would that be? About 65 years after Mark. So that's, and by the way, it's not like if you take Thomas, you're going to change your faith. There's some things in Thomas, about a third of the book is Gnostic sounding, but doesn't say, I mean, you know, it doesn't say Jesus didn't die on the cross or he wasn't raised from the dead or he wasn't divine. Thomas doesn't say that kind of stuff. So people who try to act like, if you ever hear that implication that we have to change all of Christianity, I mean, Jesus would be saying some things that are kind of Gnostic. But what I mean is they don't try to disprove the resurrection or something like that. The Gnostic books accept the deity of Christ, they accept the resurrection, they accept the death. One thing on the death, as you probably know about Gnosticism, they tend to say that the spirit left Jesus at the cross and only his body died. I mean, they don't dispute his death, but they don't want, they say spirit is the chief good, chief metaphysical category, and you can't kill spirit. And so Jesus died on the cross, but Christ didn't because the spirit, you know, went off before he died. So you see some of that in some of the later books. I mean, that's not in Thomas. But so it's not like if you accept this, oh, no, we're not going to be going to church anymore. Everything's false. I'm just saying the books are too late historiographically to make a difference. Philip is probably 100 years later than that, later than Thomas. Anyone else? Yes. Great question. Mostly Coptic from the 3rd and 4th centuries. There are some Greek fragments that would go back to, say, the 2nd century. Oh, by the way, this new gospel, the Gospel of Judas, I'm surprised that hasn't come up yet. Gospel of Judas is the most benign of these sorts of arguments. The only thing up for grabs in the Gospel of Judas is, were Jesus and Judas working together to plot his death because Jesus knew he had to die, so Judas is the good guy, not the bad guy. But Judas doesn't dispute anything. You know, do you notice how National Geographic, you know, it's just a new gospel. Oh, wow. This is the gospel we've all been afraid of, the one that's going to take its place beside the four. Gospel of Judas is 3rd to 4th century in Coptic. But we know there's got to be a Greek version of it from about 150. Why? Because Irenaeus, in his famous Against Heresies, his famous critique of Gnosticism, written about 180, critiques the Gospel of Judas. So Judas now may be as early as Thomas. It could be 150. Doesn't question any, you know, it makes Judas look like the hero because Jesus knew he had to die. And so he works in the book. He sort of gives Judas the keys to the kingdom, so to speak. He takes Judas aside and gives him secret knowledge that he doesn't give anybody else. That's one of the real earmarks of the Gnostic books. But when people are saying, wow, is this a fifth gospel? Nobody thinks that. James Robinson, this is so neat. He's the leading scholar on the Gnostic sources. And he says, Judas does not help us with any knowledge about Jesus and does not help us with any knowledge about Judas. None. Does not help us. And when they said to him, why? Robinson said, it's too late. That sounds like an evangelical talking. So, no issues. Maybe one more quick one? Yes.
I was looking at the Gospel of Thomas, and it almost looked like a play, because it said, you know, scene one, Judas and Jesus are here. It almost looks like a storybook.
Well, I'm not sure what parts you're referring to, but Gospel of Thomas, it doesn't tell you what they did. I mean, it got a few words here and there. But the Gospel of Thomas is 114 sayings. Jesus said. I'm not saying there's no other comments. You'll see a few words here and there. But Gospel of Thomas is not a narrative. He went to Bethlehem and then he went to, there's nothing like that. He talks. All it is a bunch of sayings. Like I said, I'm not saying you're not going to find a word like they went here or there. I'm not saying you won't find anything like that. I'm just saying it's almost, if you put the words of Jesus in red, just about the whole book would be red. There'd be almost no words not covered. Because it's a sayings document. It's not like a normal gospel. It's not a narrative. It doesn't tell you what he did. Okay. Hey, I'll put a little advertisement in here. We started out with a good question, about the talking to critics. And what if critics will grant you nothing? In the next lecture, I'm going to be arguing for the resurrection of Jesus. And I'm only going to use three texts, unanimously accepted by critics, two in Galatians, one in 1 Corinthians, unanimously conceded by critics as the work of Paul. And I'll show you how you can get a resurrection using only those sources. And I will cite only critics for my conclusions. So if you want to get the resurrection the way the critics do it, come on over across the hallway in a few minutes. Thank you.